Hello, everyone, and welcome to Food Safety Matters, the podcast for food safety professionals. I'm Stacey Acheson, publisher of Food Safety Magazine, and I'm here with my co-host, Barbara Van Renterham, editorial director of the magazine. And since it's time to discuss our latest Food Safety Insights column, we're happy, as always, to welcome Bob Ferguson of Strategic Consulting.
Hi, Stacey. Hi, everybody.
Yay.
Hey, Bob. All right, and for today's interview, you're going to hear Barbara's discussion with Nuno Suarez, food safety consultant and trainer with 21 years' experience in the food industry as a food safety, quality, and plant manager. Nuno is a longtime friend of the Food Safety Matters podcast. I believe that he's been listening like from the very beginning. But Nuno will always hold a special place in my heart as the first listener that answered the call to send us a voice memo. And that's not really surprising given how dedicated Nuno is to using technology to deliver his message. He's very active on social platforms and has created a lot of great content online. Like Barbara, that time he got those interviews. Like, wasn't that during GFSI?
Oh, yeah.
He had you.
World Food Safety Day, we did that.
Yeah, there were a few. Yeah. So go, Nuno. All right. So we're very pleased to have Nuno on the podcast today. So please stay tuned for that conversation. As always, you'll be glad that you did. And now for some news. Well, it's kind of like new. It's just one. It's new. I guess it's always plural. News is plural, but it's news. Just one.
I like that, though.
Do you?
That's good. I do.
Okay. So FDA has released the results of its first survey, and Barbara helped me with all this pronunciation here, of per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAS, from its total diet study. The study monitors levels of nutrients and contaminants in foods consumed in the U.S. The foods researched in the study represent the major components of the average American diet, which includes select baby foods, frozen foods, and foods in cans, boxes, or jars, which are less likely to vary by location or time of year and are generally considered non-perishable. The survey results showed that 164 of the 167 foods tested had no detectable levels of PFAS. The three food samples that did have detectable levels included fish sticks, canned tuna, and protein powder. And based on the best available current science, FDA has no scientific evidence that the levels of PFAS found in the tested samples indicate a need to avoid any particular food. FDA says that it will continue to post additional updates on its ongoing sampling and testing efforts designed to better understand the occurrence of PFAS in the food supply. Should we say, and its effects on humans?
And its effect on humans.
I would like to learn more about how they randomize the food samples that they took. I mean, Stacey, you mentioned what they consider the average American mm-hmm. diet, but I don't know. I would have liked to have seen a wider variety of foods and the data separated like by region to see if you know there was any impact in that respect.
Mm-hmm. I wish you guys could see or hear nodding. Maybe if the the bolts in my head made more noise, you could hear.
I was going to say, I did hear a rattle. I did hear a rattling sound.
Yeah.
I'm with Barb on this one. These studies, the headline doesn't really tell you what's going on because it all depends upon what is next. So in a lot of the, I went back and looked at the FDA summary. I did not read the entire study. And most of the numbers that they came up with in water were in the part per trillion level. In foods, they were tens of parts per trillion or as many as 100 parts per trillion. One of the regulatory lines, health effect lines, is 70 parts per trillion. And even in Larry's article, he mentions that there's no consensus among toxicologists on what exactly that means.
And wait a minute, before we jump to that, like everybody knows what we're talking about, our editorial advisory board member and contributor Larry Keener recently wrote an article for us. entitled The Growing Challenge of Safe Water for Use in Food Processing Operations. So we'll definitely put a link to that story in the show notes for you. So now, carry on. Larry said...
One of the things that he mentioned in that article is that there's no consensus among toxicologists on what exactly is a safe and or hazardous level of PFAS in water or food or anything at this point that I'm aware of. And I don't know the toxicology behind some of these numbers, but if there's any legitimacy to that EPA 70 part per trillion number, they've held that now for about 6 years. There must be some toxicology behind it. And the numbers that the FDA found were all either single digits for water or tens, maybe as high as 100 in some foods. And so the one thing that jumps out at me is parts per trillion is a pretty low number. And I don't know if that means that we've discovered something that no one ever knew, or the analytical technique has become more sensitive so that we discovered something that was always there. So I find that really interesting. If I can jump ahead a little bit, in Larry's article, he mentioned that the Seattle Public Utilities did testing for PFAS all throughout a number of their sample sites, and they came up with numbers around the detection level, which was 2 ppt parts per trillion, but none of them were above 10. And so now you're looking at, again, very, very low levels. And the Environmental Working Group, which also mentions, Larry also mentions, did a study of, I'm trying to picture the graph in my head right now, but there's probably 175 or 100 utilities. And most of them were all below that 70. The first third of them were below single digits. And then a few of them were quite high, meaning above the 70. But the question for me is, go to the toxicology and what does this actually mean? What does this mean from a regulatory standpoint? States are making regulations on PFAS, and so there is going to be an impact on the industry. But as far as the scientific basis of it, what next, I guess? Like you said, what exactly does 1 ppt mean? What does 10 ppt mean? And what can we do about it? That's the first thing that jumps out at me at some of these articles that have, or some of these tests that have such low levels.
Well, I did have an opportunity to speak with Larry before we recorded today, and it was quick, as in the midst of a bunch of other things, and I mentioned this study. He said, well, I wonder what the sensitivity of their detection was and the quantification and stuff like that. And he kind of ended with the provocative, if you can't do anything about the problem, declare that it's not a problem. So I said, can I quote you on that? He said, absolutely. So...
Well, you know, to your point, Bob, I was thinking that what you're not reading about with regard to these chemicals is what their biological mechanism of action in someone's right. body is. It's a hydrocarbon, right? It's an alkyl substance. So that's a hydrocarbon that will presumably accumulate in lipids, maybe, maybe not. Also, fluorine is the most active of all the halogens, and from my love of organic chemistry, when you add fluorine to things, it's never good. It's very toxic. So it might not take much to be toxic. It's like the argument you make for, you know, if you just give the dog one raise and it, you know, it's just one raise. Well, you know, sometimes just a little is, you know, toxic enough to do harm. So I think the jury is still out. You know, if we can believe the data that they're reporting compared to what EPA has been publishing on this. But there's still a lot of unanswered questions from my point of view about these chemicals.
Absolutely.
Well, I think that the discussion will definitely go on until some of these questions get answered. So...
Can I make one additional comment on why this is a subject for scientists, toxicologists, and if you ever want to have follow the science? When I was looking for the FDA report, getting ready for this, I wanted to see the original report and see what the data was. And I searched on Google and I found two things. One was a link right to the FDA report, and one was a link to a report by Bloomberg News. So, Stacy, you mentioned before 164 of 167 foods were below the detection limit. FDA has no scientific evidence that the levels found indicate any problem in any particular food, is what the FDA says. The headline in Bloomberg was, FDA finds toxic chemicals in fish sticks and canned tuna.
Right.
I was like, that's not really what they said. Technically, it's true, but that's not really what they said. So,
well, it's one of, it's part of what they said.
I mean, it's part of what they said.
Yeah, it's sort of where you put in, you know, yeah.
Right. So, wow, that's a spin.
Interesting. Well, as opposed to nothing to see nothing to see here. So I don't know. I've kind of come down on both sides of that, right? You can say, well, that's just being, well, but do you bury the lead? I don't know. What is the lead on this? Yeah, yeah, very interesting. Well, great discussion, you guys. Thank you, as always. And now, more Bob Ferguson.
Get the chat more.
It's time for some more food safety insights. So now it's time for some more insights from our partner, Bob Ferguson, president of Strategic Consulting, who will give us an overview of his latest food safety insights survey and column from the August-September issue entitled 5 years later, food safety insights, 5 years later, but part one. So there's, and there's even more to come after this.
The only thing that might be more shocking than the level of PFAS in wet water is the fact that it's been 5 years.
Yes.
For food safety insights.
That is shocking.
I know. This is like looking down and seeing it's 2021 and going, wait, what happened?
Yeah. It's particularly what happened in the last 2 years, right?
Yeah, that's right. So we have a couple more columns left, the one that's out right now, but we wanted to celebrate a little bit about 5 years with Food Safety Insights. It's been terrific, and we've covered a lot of topics in depth. So we thought we'd celebrate a little bit, look at some of the highlights of what happened in the market over the last 5 years. I picked through in the article and went through what I think are some of the top highlights, at least for the first part, and one is growth of the testing market. In Food Safety Insights, we talk about the testing market on a regular basis, and the data on the growth of the market is in the column. You'll have to read it to see. But the world market for microbiology testing has grown substantially since that first column in 2017, adding about 40% new volume. There were certainly disruptions in production and therefore testing last year, but the overall market has continued to grow and stay on this track.
On a 40% track?
Well, it's 40% cumulative between 2017 and today. So it's about a 7 or 8% growth, depending upon what type of testing you're looking at, which is still pretty healthy.
Mm-hmm.
Still very healthy. The other part of this is the growth of pathogen testing particularly, and the growth of listeria testing. Key to this growth has been the growth in pathogens, and many processors have realized that listeria survives in more places than we once thought, and additional testing has really been building up over the last 5 years to get rid of those harborage organisms. So you see pathogen testing growing at between 7 and 8% on an annual basis, so a CAGR-type basis, but listeria is well above 8%. So still very healthy growth. And listeria in the last 5 years went from being the second most tested pathogen to by far the first. So that's been a significant change, both for the diagnostic companies, for the food processors, and also for the regulators and how they're looking at this. The other topic that we visited frequently is whole genome sequencing. Certainly has been driven by CDC, FDA, and the genome tracker. But that trend was the use of WGS, which we've reported on, but mainly by the regulators. But it's still not taking off so much with the food processors. And really, as the test volume keeps growing, the food processors are looking at this closely, but they just don't see the use in using it for day-to-day testing, is what we hear on a regular basis. If you're going to do a study, if you're going to do a search and destroy type study, you might want to take some sequences, but most people are still not doing that, at least from a food processing standpoint. And then the last and probably the biggest impact over the last 5 years for the market in general has been outsourcing to laboratories. Where are all these samples going? The large amount of pathogens, most of them are now going to commercial labs. And this is particularly the case with things like the extra listeria volume and all the other pathogen volume. For commercial labs, when we first started Food Safety Insights, we were seeing numbers that were approaching 50% of the test volume going to labs and the other half staying in food processors. Now we think the level is in the 60s, probably generally across North America, less so in Europe and far less in Asia. But in some of the surveys that we've seen this year, We've seen surveys where food processors are telling us that 75% of their volume is going out, and that's cumulative. Any one particular processor is probably either doing it in-house or not, but over the course of the market, the entire view of the market, 75% of pathogen samples are now going to commercial labs when 5-10 years ago they were being done in plant. So that's significant. And many of the labs are seeing 10, 12 or higher growth. Certainly some of the bigger labs are seeing growth above that. And for most labs, pathogen testing and microbiology is their fastest growing area. So that's changed quite a bit in the last 5 years. So that's one of the bigger ones. So those are the four big testing highlights that we've seen. We've got some others that we'll look at later too.
It's just so great to be able to have that long view and stack it all up over the years. It really is a different view. So it's so great, Bob, to have you partnering with us to do this work. And as we've noted here, that's a lot about testing. And so do you think that this type of growth is going to continue?
In the surveys we've done, we've had a couple of articles this year. It shows pretty clearly that this is not going to slow down anytime soon. One of the questions we've asked frequently is, in the next 2 years, how much do you see your testing increasing or decreasing? And increasing always outweighs decreasing. The issue is how much. Some people say as much as 10%. Some people say as much as 2%. But almost no one says we're going to stop testing as much as we are. It's just not something that they're going to reverse. Occasionally, you'll find a processor that says, we've been running hundreds of samples a month. We're not finding anything. Now maybe we'll run 80 or something like that. But no one is saying that they're going to reverse course. So I think this is going to continue to grow. At some point, there's a ceiling on how many samples there'll be. But then I think from a world standpoint, you'll start to see tremendous growth in places like South America, Africa, and maybe Asia, where you don't have quite the growth. You see that in beef in Brazil, which has really come up in the last couple of years after the scandals they've had. So there's still a lot of room for a lot of growth, but at some point we'll hit a ceiling in maybe the developed areas.
So Bob, I was wondering if you could tease what's in part two.
So we try to ask a lot of questions. I like talking about testing, like we have this whole podcast, but I like talking about testing. But in part two, we're going to cover some of the other subjects. And I think there's another couple of key areas that we found in outside of testing as well. And that's FSMA, certainly COVID-19. We've talked about quite a bit, the overall impact on the markets and supply chains and some of the changing things in supply chains, not only that were changing before COVID, but are going to change permanently from COVID. And that's in part two.
Yeah.
Awesome. I wanted to ask you a question about Listeria testing. Do you think that it's grown because Listeria is not only a threat in the food product itself, but it's also ubiquitous in the environment? So do you think that drives how much Listeria testing is going on?
If I had to put it in a sentence or two, I think the main reason for Listeria testing growing the way it is there was a lot of assumptions made about how long Listeria lasted a plant, where it stayed, again, how ubiquitous it was. And I think some of the assumptions were wrong. And then when people started to test more, they started to find more. And when people changed their approach to this idea that don't test until you don't find anything, but test until you do find something and then get rid of it, that has changed and caused people to run more tests to purposely find things. And I think that's what it was. Some of the diagnostics out there that can find evidence of Listeria, particularly RNA that's been around for years, has changed people's views on what was in their plant at one point and how it got there. So I think that really was a mindset change.
Interesting.
All right. Well, if you want to read part one, you can go to food-safety.com. You'll find the article in our current issue there. And then you get to see all the pretty charts and graphs that go with that as well. We do like that. That's an integral part of our Food Safety Insights columns. And we'll, of course, provide a link to that, as well as all the references that we've mentioned in our show notes. You'll find those in your podcast player or at food-safety.com. Then find episode 103. Those numbers. I'm still with the numbers. Please. Also, of course, don't forget to follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook. Just search for Food Safety Magazine. And now, It's time for Barbara's interview with Nuno Suarez, an author, consultant, and trainer in food safety with more than 21 years background in the food industry as a food safety, quality, and plant manager. He works exclusively to help food safety professionals achieve a more fulfilled career based on improving knowledge, improving competencies, and a growing mindset. He's also the founder of the initiative The Why of Food Safety. I'm an SLO, which stands for Saving Lives Officer. In addition, he's the author of several books and articles on food safety.
I always like talking to him because he has more energy for food safety than most people that I know. And his efforts to promote his podcast, so he wants to do a little photo thing that he can post on LinkedIn. So watch out for that. So he's going to be memorializing the podcast on LinkedIn too when it comes out. So, but he, you know, I think even though in SLO you're like, what is that? But I really think, you know, that he has a knack for developing some unique mantras for the industry and driving the training that he does to help people. He's really passionate about it.
And you'll get to hear all of that passion now.
Hi, Nuno. Well, welcome to the podcast. I'm really looking forward to speaking with you about how to have a fulfilling career in food safety. And you're well on your way to that. So let's get started.
Thanks, Barbara. Thanks. Really, I'm so proud for your invitation. You know, you must know this. I followed the podcast pretty much from day one. So maybe you remember my Christmas message back in 2017, right? At the time, I replied to Stacy Challenge and sent a voice message wishing all the team a happy Christmas. So I believe technically we can say that this is my second time on podcast, right? So really excited to be here with you, Barbara.
I'll give it to you. So we go back more than 5 years. I had to look back in all the emails that we've exchanged over that period of time when Bill Sperber, and he was a guest on episode 19 or episode 9. I'm going to say that again. So Drew, I'm going to start this over. So when Nuno stopped talking, I'm going to pick it up here. So we go back more than 5 years. You know, I had to dig around in the archives of my emails that we've exchanged over that time. Back when Bill Sperber, who, as you might recall, was a guest very early, episode 9, he suggested that you get in touch about some of the projects that you were working on. At that time, you were working on your PhD and had just finished a book on seafood safety. And so a short time later, you introduced this really interesting concept of being an SLO for food safety. And so for those of our listeners who don't know, that is the idea of becoming a saving lives officer. So I'd love for you to start us off with how you came up with this concept and how it's evolved over
yes,
that
yes,
time.
Barbara, thank you. You are right. Well, we were introduced by Bill Sperber. And before I reply to your question, please let me honor first Bill, because I believe that the friendly microbiologist doesn't know how important he was to this stage of my career. Bill accepted to participate in the book I wrote, but much more important than this, Bill showed me how humble and available a food safety professional should be. I am so grateful I have met him and that we exchanged his message throughout these years. He even sent me some of his works and papers by mail and with his handwriting and notes. So he's a really special person. So thank you. Thank you, Bill, for that. Now let's move on and talk a little bit about the IMSLO. And I'm really excited to share this with you here in your podcast. But this comes with a little story, Barbara. Back in 2019, I was reading a lot about the why. Okay, I saw the video, and maybe more people have seen it, and read the Simon Sinek book, Starting with Why, and then he published another book, Find Your Why. And these readings were very important to me to shift gears in my career, but also to start looking to the why of food safety. By then, I had 20 years in the food industry, and I was very aware that food safety professionals' work is not easy. We are most of the times between top management and all the other people in the organization. And you know how that is challenge, right? We have to know how to motivate top management to look for food safety as a priority, but we have also to know how to motivate the other workers to do what they are supposed to do, even when no one is looking. And in the process, in this process, we often forget something. We also need the energy, the drive to do our work, okay? So how can we be motivated to wake up every day to do our job? What helped me to reply to this question was another topic I am passionate about, human behavior. What moves people? How can we inspire them? You know, studies show that deep motivation comes from inside, from our search to fulfill some higher human needs, such as recognition and purpose, for example. So, Barbara, what food safety professionals do that can fulfill these higher human needs? And my vision is that we should look at what we do, our daily work, as tools to achieve our higher purpose, saving people's lives. And remember, the numbers are clear. Hundreds of thousands die each year from eating contaminated food. If we assure safe food, we are saving people's life. This way, and my first suggestion back in 2019 was, well, we food safety professionals should change our business cards to SLO. So the saving lives officer, or at least add it, right? So you may have quality manager and SLO, or food safety director and SLO. You know, Barbara, related with this, I want to share you another thing. I'm reading a book now. It's about the monk, you know, and I also realized that IMSLO will help workers find what in Sanskrit is called a dharma. Dharma is a very interesting concept because dharma is using our natural inclinations, the things we are good at, to serve others. I work with collaborate with many young professionals, and it's common to see them looking for their passion. They want to work for something they are passionate about. We should feel passionate about what we do, for sure, but we must also have the skills to do it. Because in the end, nothing matters if what you do is not useful. So, dharma is a simple formula: passion plus expertise plus usefulness. We need the three to be totally fulfilled. If we have the passion and expertise about something, but it's not useful, what we have probably is only a hobby. Makes sense? Okay. Right. So, right. I think IMS SLO is perfect for professionals to understand how useful it is to use their passion and expertise around food safety. Okay, well, meanwhile, I am suggesting now that everyone is in the organization should be a SLO. I believe that the IMS SLO mindset should be the building block to develop positive food safety culture.
So, you know, we've talked to other folks on the podcast who have been instrumental in food safety culture. We've had, of course, Frank Giannis on the podcast. We've had Lone Jesperson on the podcast. We just, I think later this week, we're going to have our third or final webinar in our global food safety culture series. So we've had four of those already. That is a big deal in food safety these days. What components do you feel help a company develop that within their organization? And what ideas can you share, and what tips do you have for companies to continue to empower employees?
That's really a great question, Barbara. And you know, Barbara, the first thing I want to share with you is that in every organization, there is a food safety culture, okay? And yes, you heard me right. Every organization has a food safety culture, since To develop one, the only thing we need are collaborating personnel. When people join together to work, and even in other social circumstances, a culture naturally evolves. So a culture around food safety is always developed, even if you don't do anything. The question is this the culture you want? Is this a positive food safety culture? Most probably not. This way, I believe food industry organizations must be in charge of the development of their food safety culture to ensure it best promotes and assures safe food to consumers. I don't advise you to play Russian roulette with food safety culture. Not only you will get hurt, but, well, consumers' health and your organization reputation are on the line, okay? So, I believe the I'm a SLO mindset is previous to the tools, right? But let me share you a framework I believe can be used to develop the I'm SLO mindset. I usually advise organizations to use four steps. First, establish an unequivocal relationship between lack of food safety and disease or death. Second, make sure people know what they do and how they do it matters. Third, guarantee psychological safety. And fourth, efficient communication. May I develop this, Barbara?
Oh, of course.
Awesome, awesome. So on the basis of everything, we have to establish an unequivocal relationship between lack of food safety and disease or death. This should be crystal clear. And the numbers don't lie. But the issue is that numbers don't move people. You have to use emotions, okay? If you only show some numbers or talk about microorganisms and temperatures or CCPs, this has a limited impact. We have to make them feel, and the word is to feel the impact of lack of food safety. Nothing like a real story of a son who lost his mother or a father who lost his daughter simply because of contaminated food to trigger empathy and thinking the importance of food safety. This is the first step, okay? Establish an unequivocal and emotional relationship between lack of food safety and disease or death. In my first step, I suggest emotion, but in the second, I recommend reason. The second step is making clear that what each of us do and how we do it matters. This is the place to be specific. Be very specific. Forget those empty sentences of everybody is important. If you want to have impact, you have to be specific. You have to explain exactly to everyone how the specific tasks they do, how it contributes to food safety. Or if you prefer, you may clarify that food will be unsafe when they do it wrongly, okay? The third step, Barbara, is psychological safety. And this term, well, this was coined by Amy Edmondson, and we can define it as a belief that one will not be punished or humiliated for speaking up with ideas, questions, concerns, or mistakes. As you easily understand, as everybody easily understands, this concept is broader than food safety. And in fact, as a major contribution to successful teams and even to reduce depressing induction work environments. In the IMSLO mindset, people must be free to talk, raise concerns, and act upon problems. Of course, according to their responsibilities and authorities. But they should be able to press the red button when food safety is a stake. Now, we reach the fourth step, right? The icing on the top of the cake is efficient communication. We have to find the balance between general or broader communication that we can do with many people at the same time, okay, and specific communication. For example, if in the first step about establishing relationship between lack of food safety and disease or death, we can do it in groups of people, and in a broader presentation, step two requires a more tailored and individual communication, as you should go to each workplace and explain exactly what should be done and the consequence of doing it wrongly. Regarding communication, I want to share something. It's also important to understand that each person is different and has different needs and different aspirations, right? And if we want to have effective communication, we need to acknowledge that and adapt our communication accordingly. So, in a nutshell, these are the four steps for me. Establish an unequivocal relationship between lack of food safety and disease and death. Make sure people know what they do and how they do it matters. Guarantee psychological safety and efficient communication. Sounds good? Sounds good?
It sounds perfectly good. It gave me an idea, though. You know, I've often talked to people about how you engage employees, and it's exactly as you're stating, that you need to put a face. It's not just enough to throw up statistics to your employees and say, this percentage gets sick each year. You need to make it real for them. But do you think the same mindset would work with consumers about food handling and food storage and, you know, keeping foods at the proper temperature, especially here in New England, we're getting a heat wave. So, you know, hopefully 4th of July, people won't be having the potato salad sitting out in the 90 degree heat. You know, so there's always a disconnect. How far do food companies go to educate their consumers and their customers? But maybe making the message mean something different, and maybe the messaging, making the messaging more engaging, would help that. Any thoughts?
Yes, Barbara. Well, what I think is that the food industry is a large industry with a lot of people working. So I think if we can talk with the employees inside the industry, and if we can convince people that are in the industry already that this is important, I think they can go home and talk with others and also share this, the importance of taking care and having good practice with food. So I think we can, of course, we can do some promotions on social or on TV and even with governments, because I think the role must be divided, because, well, this is not only the responsibility of the industry, in my opinion. But I think that first we have to make this very clear for our own, let's say like this. So if we believe it, I think we then can go home and also transmit this to other persons, the importance of these concerns to other persons.
That's a great point. So we're just starting, at least here in the States, everything getting back to some semblance of normal after the pandemic. But do you think that COVID has really affected food safety professionals in taking on this SLO role in the industry? Has it kind of delayed it, put it on the back burner, for example?
No, I don't think so. You know, Barbara, I love a quote from Friedrich Nietzsche that says, "He who has a why to live for can bear almost anyhow." And let me repeat it because I like it so much. "He who has a why to live for can bear almost anyhow." And I read this quote in one of my all-time favorite books, that's Man's Search for Meaning. And the author, Viktor Frankl, was detained in several concentration camps. Okay, and in a nutshell, he explains in the book that most of the detainees die few days after they stop believing it was worth continuing, okay? And they were no longer saw a purpose for keep fighting. This is how powerful having a purpose can be, you know? So this pandemic, it's a horrible thing. It took over the world and impacted people and business. But I think food safety professionals, they were in the first line because food business couldn't stop, okay? And this should make us all proud, because even facing unprecedented challenge, food safety professionals contributed to maintain the supply chain working and guarantee safe food was reaching consumers. What about that as a purpose, right? So I believe this pandemic proven that all food safety professionals should wake up in the morning with the energy, because now, if they didn't before, now they know what they do matter. What they do is essential, and this pandemic was bring that to the surface more clear than ever. Food safety professionals are very important, and what we do matters. And of course, the food industry is very important and paramount to surviving, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. So I'd like to pivot now to a new project that you're working on, and that's Lean HACCP. So I'd love to get an overview of this concept and, you know, where you're going with that.
Sure, sure, Barbara. Well, this may be a little bit long, so, but well, I always like to bring a little bit of a story, and well, and in this case, I think I have to explain a little bit about Lean, because I'm not sure if everybody is clear about that. So Lean and Lean Sigma, Six Sigma and Hazard Analysis Critical Control Points, or HACCP, they are two very different concepts and even worlds, but I believe there are some connection points between those two methodologies, okay? HACCP implementation can benefit by the use of some Lean principles and tools. That's why I came up with the Lean HACCP concept, okay? But maybe let's a little bit explain Lean philosophy for food safety professionals who are listening to us today. Lean philosophy looks to the organization and to the Gemba. The Gemba is the operations, right? And they look at the organization and Gemba as places where changes have always a goal to add value and or reduce waste, okay? And if you look to the principles of Lean methodology, some of them are, for example, continuous flow process and reduce waiting times, standardization, ensuring stable working methods, use of visual controls for better communication of indicators and relevant information, and continuous improvement. And you can see these four examples, these four principles are, I believe it's clear for everybody that works with HACCP, that these are also relevant for us, okay? Look, we like to continuous flow process, and you don't want food standing by, especially if there are conditions for microbiological growth, right? So standardization is key. In HACCP, we even use the flowcharts to visualize and understand the sequence of steps. And this is very important because it has an impact in hazards, okay? The communication of relevant information is crucial for HACCP, right? And, well, we all agree that continuous improvement is paramount. In fact, in the last update of the General Principles of Food Hygiene from the Codex, there is encouraging continuous improvement. Encouraging is one of the roles of management, okay, as they put it there. So for me, this makes clear that many of the principles of Lean are significant for HACCP, okay? But I would like to share two or three tools that are common, okay, Barbara? Awesome. So I would like to talk, and maybe I can start by talking about waste reduction, okay? If we go and you study a little bit Lean, you see that Lean identifies seven key areas of waste, okay? Overproduction, waiting, transport, motion, over-processing, inventory, and defects, okay? And more recently, let me share about this one. More recently, an eighth key area of waste has been proposed: unused talent or the waste of human potential, right?
Right.
And this waste occurs especially in organizations where workers are expected only to follow orders and execute as planned. They are neither included nor heard in identifying problems or developing solutions. Okay, and this is an important message for food safety professionals. Make sure you hear and consider suggestions when developing HACCP. But this is also an important message for top management, as this waste is not limited to frontline workers, but oftentimes food safety professionals' talent and potential is wasted as well, okay? So if we focus, after this parenthesis, if we focus on waste, let's focus, for example, in transport and movement, okay? If a worker, for example, has to move 2.5 meters to go to get a tool and come back, if 10 times a day, for example, at the end of the year, she will lose 3 hours of work just to get that tool, okay? This is impressive. But when we look to HACCP, we are not focusing so much on productivity, of course, but on food safety. So my suggestion is look at your facility layout. are their processes not close to each other, forcing people to move away and come back? How many times, and I share this by experience, how many times do workers go to the warehouse to get labels? Remember, movement and transport do not add any value to the product, but can potentially add contamination. Right. Okay, so be very careful with the movement inside your organization. You are losing time and you are increasing contamination potentially, right? Another tool that is very known in Lean is the 5S. 5S is a system designed to create order from chaos, okay? Who hasn't opened a drawer inside a food manufacturing facility, for example, just to see a mix of unnecessary and even forbidden items, okay? Even we saw this during audits sometimes, okay? So this is where the 5S systems comes in handy to clean up and organize the workplace. The 5S's stand for sort, set in order, shine, standardize, and sustain. Okay, briefly, sort is separate what is necessary, what is needed from the unneeded or forbidden even, right? So remove what's not necessary. Unneeded items are potential sources of contamination and foreign materials. So take it out, right? Set in order, neatly arrange and identify what is needed. Organize items. For example, identify and separate food contact and non-food contact items. Okay, the shine. Shine is clean. Now that you have removed what's not necessary and set everything in order, it's time to clean it up. Okay, standardize is more like schedule. Okay, you have to schedule regular cleaning and maintenance. Okay, this means we should do regularly the sort, set, and shine. Okay, you should schedule this. And finally, we have to sustain. Okay, you have to make 5S a routine and an element of the workplace positive food safety culture. Consider doing regular checks by supervisors to make sure procedures are followed. Okay, so regularly assess any additional opportunities of improvement. So this was the second tool, 5S. Finally, if I may, I would like to share the last tool. This is what we can call the visual workplace. And this is more common in ASAP. For example, we use visual workplace, for example, with cleaning tools. I believe most of the professionals listening to us use or observed the use of different colors for cleaning tools to make it easier for workers to know if this brush is to be used inside production or outside. Another common example in commercial kitchens is the use of different designated colors, food cutting boards, okay? So for different products, vegetables, meats, poultry, fish, this is to prevent also cross-contamination. So information is paramount for ASAP success and should be easily understandable and available at the point and moment of use. I know by experience how often errors occur in business from bad information and lack thereof, okay? When work-related information is not available, either the workers lose time looking for it, or even worse, they do their job unsure if that is what is supposed to be done. Okay, so for example, if after you sort, set in order, shine, and standardize a drawer, imagine, what better to sustain that define a visual layout for all the needed content? For example, you can do a shadow draw on the bottom of the drawer with the place for the notepad, the pencil, the calculator, whatever. Okay, this will make clear if something is there that is not supposed to be. Okay, other examples I can share of visual devices can be required personnel protective equipment notice, for example. Food safety work instructions at the point of need, okay, that is important, not in the office. Clear traffic paths to avoid cross-contamination. Signs for storage of products with different halogens. Labels with expected values at monitoring points. Instructions for the correct use of cleaning agents, etc., okay? Well, Barbara, as I told you, this is a little bit long reply, but hopefully people now have a better idea what I mean, right?
Yeah, I was thinking that those are good principles to apply to everyone's junk drawer in the kitchen.
Right. Yes, start at home.
I think that's a great idea. Now, when you and I were kicking around ideas on what we wanted to talk about today, you mentioned that this concept of Lean HACCP has been very well received. Can you give our listeners an idea of some of the feedback that you've received?
Yes, Barbara, of course. Well, I'm getting great feedback from this. And you know, Barbara, I'm writing about food safety at least once a month, okay, since January 27. By now, I already have an idea when a subject resonates with food safety professionals, okay? So the Lean HACCP article was the most seen and comment article of the year so far. But besides social media, what I got was two kind of feedbacks. I got feedback from professionals who are already using, okay, some Lean tools and reached me to share what they do besides what were my suggestions, right? And asked me to talk more about it. Okay, this was one kind of feedback. And I also get feedback from food safety professionals who didn't know or never saw the potential of using these tools and thank me for that, for the idea. But well, the truth is that these are still the first steps of this idea, and I'm really excited about how this will develop in the future.
Yeah, so an obvious question is, what are your goals for moving this concept forward?
Well, Barbara, the goal, I have to share with you this. The goal of Lean HACCP and for everything I do is the same, okay, is really on my mission, right? So when you open my website, the first thing you see is I support food safety professionals into impactful and fulfilled career, okay? So that sentence is the compass for everything I do. If I can develop tools or trainings to do it, I will. If I have an idea or a new concept that I believe adds value to food safety professional, I'm happy to share it for free in my monthly articles, as was the case of Lean HACCP. What really matters for me is that food safety professionals collaborate and work together to assure safe food to consumers. What I would also like to emphasize is that we don't need to reinvent the wheel, okay? What I mean is this. I'm not doing it with Lean HACCP. I'm not inventing anything. I think this is an important message because food safety professionals often are too closed inside their own food safety cocoons, let's say like that, and don't look to other aspects of the business, sometimes our own business, okay, or even other business that take advantage of tools and principles that are successful there. Go. And I sincerely hope that food safety professionals can do more of that because it's important. We have to broaden our sight and take in and welcome these new ideas from other aspects of the business, right?
I absolutely agree with you. You know, before my life as the editor of Food Safety Magazine, I worked in publishing and other disciplines that I see a lot of similarities, going to a conference and seeing the same vendors on the show floor, but with different, you know, areas that they can apply those same tools across different industries. So I absolutely agree with you. So Nuno, as we wrap up today, if you had your crystal ball there in Portugal, what do you feel is the next big challenge for food safety professionals to overcome?
Well, Barbara, I will like to, maybe I can split this reply in two, because I like to talk about food safety professionals and I like to talk about food systems, okay, in general. For food safety professionals, I will say speed and trust, okay, speed and trust. And they are somehow interconnected because speed is a characteristic of the age we live on, okay, everything is fast. The speed new products are developed and introduced in the market, in which new trends emerge and organizations run to fulfill them, is way faster than regulations to control it are developed or to allow organizations taking enough time to study and fully understand potential hazards. This fast pace is also a fertile land for fraud. Fraud is especially attractive in these new products as they are less or not regulated at all. And are not well, even, and these products are not well known by the consumers. They really don't know what to expect. So, and even And because these new products often are not developed by well-established organizations with a reputation to protect, okay? Because commonly these organizations take more time and are more cautious to launch a product to the market.
Sure.
So, of course, this speed can impact trust, because as consumers have bad experience with these products, they may lose trust in all the products, not only the ones they are buying at the moment.
Sure.
Okay? So
sure.
The challenge is, can we balance the fast speed of our modern society with the need to develop appropriate studies, process to produce safe food, and the necessary regulations and controls, okay, and avoid fraud and bad experience with the industry? This is the balance, and this is a challenge. And let me elaborate a little bit more on trust, because I also like to talk about the volunteer certification programs and also about governmental controls. Okay, in a study published last year, was found that only 20% of the consumers have complete confidence their food is safe to eat. And I think we have to address this, okay? Consumers need to trust controls, government, and also the certification programs. In my vision, most consumers are not really aware of these controls. Probably most of them have a nebulous idea that food products must be controlled somehow, but they don't know how. A lot can be done on this, okay? Governments should be more open to share information on how, what, and when they control the industry. Consumers must understand that independently of how many controls there are, there is always a chance, of something going wrong. Especially because no one is controlling, as you were telling me before, no one is controlling what consumer is doing itself, right?
Right. I want to thank you, Nuno, for being a guest on the podcast. Yes, your second official time with us, and we'll be certain to have you back, because there's a lot more to talk about, and I've jotted down some notes so we can do this again.
Awesome, Barbara. Well, as you know, it's a really pleasure to be here, and it's a really pleasure to talk with you and well. And thank you for the opportunity, and thank you for all the good work you do in the magazine and the podcast. I read it, and I used all the knowledge to share with other persons. So I'm a raving fan from your podcast.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Nuno Suarez and Bob Ferguson for joining us on the podcast today. And of course, thanks to all of you for listening. As always, you'll find links to the references that we've mentioned in the episode in our show notes. You can access those on your podcast player or on our website at food-safety.com. Hit that podcast tab in the top navigation and then find episode 103. And don't hesitate. Send us questions and suggestions to podcast@foodsafetymagazine.com or post a note on Twitter, LinkedIn, or Facebook. And you can make sure that new and bonus episodes magically appear in your podcast player by clicking that subscribe button. And while you're there, it never hurts to take a minute and rate the podcast. You know, throw some stars our way. It's good for everyone. All right, that's it for us today. Our next regular episode will post on September 28th. Take good care of yourselves and those around you, and we'll talk to you then.